In the policymaking space, economists can be perceived as, well, party poopers for the level of scrutiny they apply to a proposed policy and for delivering the bad news when it doesn't pass the smell test. But is it what economists say about policies, or is it more about how they say it?
I think at the end of the day, we're always going to be skunks at the garden party, but it's a question of how skunky we are. I think some skunks are easier to invite than others. And so I do think there are a bunch of things that economists can do to make us seen as a more attractive and vital part of the conversation.
And it's not only politicians and policymakers that economists need to convince of their findings.
If the public isn't behind an idea or a direction we need to go in, then it's going to be very difficult for a political leader to go down that road. I'm Karen Dinan, and I am a professor of the practice at Harvard University in their economics department and at the Kennedy School. And I am also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Dinan is also the author of Reclaiming a Policy Role for Economists, published in the June issue of Finance and Development magazine. Jeff Kearns sat down with Dinan to talk about the article and how to bring economic thinking out of the dark.
Okay, well, Karen, thank you for being here today, and we really appreciate getting to talk to you a little bit more about this. The question I want to lead off with, how does the profession look different to you when you bring economic policy advice into the political arena, where it may be something that's seen in a different way?
I think the element that we bring to the conversation when it comes to policymaking is that we think in terms of trade-offs. So it's rare to find a policy, even one with lots of benefits, that doesn't come with some costs or risks. And the way economists tend to approach things is that we think about these trade-offs as we are evaluating what the right decision is to make.
And as someone who spent many years at the Federal Reserve Board before going to the Council of Economic Advisers and to the Treasury later, do those trade-offs look different? Do the same things sound different?
Sure. There are differences. There are differences by institution, and I think there have been some changes over time. So just going from institution to institution, the Fed is an institution full of technocrats. So really, economists would have a lot of voice in the decisions because really the policymakers were just focused on the economic trade-offs. I think when you go to these other entities that are more political, like the Council of Economic Advisers or the Treasury Department, you're talking to people who have to think about the politics. They have to think about whether the idea is going to sell with the Hill, for example, if it's something that requires legislation. They are thinking about how the business community is going to respond. They are thinking about how consumers are going to respond. So that's a very different set of factors that enter every decision. And so the economists are just one voice in the room. So, that's the changes, as you go from institution to institution. But I think there have also been changes over time in the role of technocrats. I think even in those more political conversations in earlier decades, there was more weight put on the view of the economists or the technocrats. The economic trade-offs really did kind of dominate people's thinking. And over time, for a variety of reasons, including growing distrust of experts and growing political polarization, the weight put on economists has been diminished. It has, it's a factor that is considered, but it's not as important a factor as in times past.
And to pick up on what you said, you mentioned being the voice in the room. Was that kind of public policy role one of the things that made you decide that you wanted to become an economist?
Sure. I actually, the story of my choice to become an economist starts when I was a teenager, and my dad lost his job in the turmoil that occurred in the United States in the late 70s and early 80s. And I didn't really know this term at the time, but I do know it now. He was among the long-term unemployed because he did not get a job for quite a while. And it was only when I went to college that I realized, wow, economists have these tools. They have these policy levers they can use that have a profound impact on macroeconomic conditions. And that, in turn, will have a profound impact on people's lives. So that's really what drew me in, was I wanted to be one of the people in the room where it happens, helping them make the right decision in terms of economic policy.
And then you became one of those people. You went to the Treasury Department in Washington, and you were the chief economist and assistant secretary for economic policy. But you also said the Treasury economists were seen as skunks at the garden party. Why is that?
Because economists, so you have these meetings where lots of different types of people are invited to help figure out what the right direction is to take economic policy. And the economists are kind of one of many people in the room, but the economists are the people who come in and talk about the hard trade-offs. They, you know, when you're evaluating a policy to stabilize the economy or increase economic mobility, you know, there are always lots of good ideas of policies that will generate benefits, but there's always a question of, you know, what are the costs? And those costs can be budget costs. I hear a lot from, for example, my students. They present me with their 5-point plan to increase productivity or to increase economic security among households. But, you know, I go back to them and I say, okay, but how's your government going to finance that? So there are the economic costs, but then there are just other types of important trade-offs. So if you think about, you know, a classic example would be minimum wage policy. Often it's the case when you raise the minimum wage, that will help some workers who do have jobs and were working at wages below the new minimum wage, but there may be a trade-off in terms of firms not demanding as many workers. So the economists are the people who come in and bring that kind of what's taken as bad news with them, which is why we often feel like we're darkening people's doorways or we're the skunks at the party. But we also, it's really important that the decision makers hear that.
So you said that the thinking of economists is grounded in trade-offs and constraints, and these need to be present when you're in the room and you're talking about policies. But you've also seen an erosion of the influence of the profession. How do you preserve that influence that is so important?
Yeah, so I don't think it's a matter of backing off about the trade-offs. I think the decision makers, they need to hear those trade-offs. They need to understand the costs when they're evaluating whether to go forward. And it's certainly been the case in my experience that I've pitched a policy which is the right one from the perspective of economists, but the person I'm working for has told me, oh, yeah, I understand that, but it's not going to fly politically. And that's okay, because at least that person has evaluated everything to make their decision, and they're not going to be caught off guard if they're sitting in a room with a smart reporter or a business leader who is unhappy with the policy. So I don't think we should back off from that role, but I do think there are, you know, several things that economists can do to try to reclaim our role, to basically help people understand again that we should be, you know, a fundamental part of the policy conversation.
And you've also seen that the profession has made some missteps that have
exactly
maybe diminished its credibility.
Yeah. So that's where I was going. I think to reclaim our, you know, the first important thing we need to do to reclaim our influence in the policy conversation is to go back to episodes where the recommendations that economists made had outcomes that created hardship for people or created problems with the macroeconomic environment that we didn't anticipate. So I think it's really important that we go back and we figure out that, first of all, that we fess up to those missteps, but also that we go back and we figure out, well, what was the problem? Was it that our models were wrong? Was it that we didn't have the data we needed? You know, what could we do to avoid this happening next time? But I think there are several prominent examples from the last couple of decades. One would be the global financial crisis, where few economists understood that a housing bubble was building until it was too late. And even fewer economists understood how the popping of that bubble was going to create effects that rippled throughout the global financial system. So that would be one example. A second example would be the austerity that the United States, but other countries, including many countries in Europe, put in place too soon after the global financial crisis, when countries really hadn't gotten on track to experience robust economic recovery, and many people were still kind of suffering. And then a third example would be the post-pandemic inflation, which many economists didn't understand even as it was happening. They didn't understand exactly what was going on, and they didn't understand how it was going to play out. They didn't understand how high inflation might go and how long inflation would persist. And I would say, as I think about those three episodes, the first two, the global financial crisis and the post-crisis austerity, I think economists actually have done a good job of going back and figuring out what went wrong and how we need to change our thinking such that we do better next time. With regard to the post-pandemic inflation, I don't think we're there yet.
So there's been some loss of public trust,
yeah.
But you also think that there's ways that the profession can earn back some lost trust.
Right. So I think, so one is taking a closer look at these episodes where we have misstepped and being transparent that those were missteps, explaining why that happened. Second, I think, is paying closer attention to what people are saying when it comes to economic developments. If you take, for example, the backlash to what's called the China shock here in the United States, I think economists had assumed when we opened up access or greater access to trade here in the United States, they understood that some industries and some geographies would suffer, but thought, well, you know, that'll all work out. People will move to places where there are jobs. It didn't happen. And I think what we didn't really recognize at the time was that there are tremendous frictions to people relocating like that. And also maybe that people didn't really want to pick up and leave the place where their parents and grandparents had lived. So I think, so that's one kind of example of how we could listen better. I think another example would just be around inflation. And I know this from teaching macroeconomics, that economists kind of take a simplistic view about the costs of inflation. They say, well, prices go up, but wages go up too, so it works out, you know, okay in the end for everybody. But really, some of the recent research we've seen, including from my colleague Stephanie Stancheva at Harvard, has suggested that people really don't like inflation for, you know, reasons that aren't captured by our economic models. So I think it's important that we listen to people so that we know where we need to add more nuance to our models. I mean, we know our models are overly simplistic. We can't put every factor in the world into them, but it's a question of what are the nuances that it's important to capture.
Listening is important, and also speaking for the profession.
Yeah.
And what is it about, you talk about the models that economists use and the numbers and the equations and formulas. Isn't that what matters?
Yeah.
Is it really more than that to also know how to speak to a broad audience?
And so I'm sure this will resonate with you, given your background in communications. Yeah, it's important that we apply the sophisticated tools that we have when we're, you know, wrestling with a difficult analysis or trying to forecast what's going to happen in the future. But when it comes to going into that room where the policy conversation is being had, you're not going to be served well by bringing in a bunch of technical material that folks don't understand. So you need to go in there and speak to them at the level that they're at. I think there are some people who come in with very technical material thinking, well, it's going to blow people away and they won't be able to critique it because they don't really understand it. That's not a recipe for sustained influence in the policy conversation. You need to avoid that. But I think the more common situation is people, you know, perhaps don't want to insult the intelligence of their colleagues. But I think I haven't, you know, it's hard for me to think of an instance where I've been in a broad policy conversation where people weren't well served by, you know, an analysis expressed in a way that everybody could understand. So that's true in the policymaking conversation. I think kind of more broadly, economists need to go out there and engage with the public at the level that they can understand. At the end of the day, it's going to be the public who guides decision makers as they determine economic policy. And if the public isn't behind an idea or a direction we need to go in, then it's going to be very difficult for a political leader to go down that road.
And the goal with communication is to build trust.
It's to build trust. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's not just economists, it's other experts who have lost the trust of the public to a surprising degree. And there are lots of reasons for that. But I think one reason is that we don't communicate in ways that are compelling to the public. And that invites, that creates a vacuum such that other voices that are not grounded in the evidence and the data and sound analysis can come in with their ideas.
And then to bring it back, you talked about how you were personally shaped and your professional path was drawn away by the economic turbulence of the late 70s. The role you now have is as a professor who's working with the next generation of economists. And so how are you addressing these issues that you talked about engagement and communication and trust with the next generation that you're helping to shape?
You know, when we're educating our students, there are a lot of different things that our students need to know. Students certainly need their basic grounding in the models and in the data that they'll get from the textbook. The course that I teach actually is focused on the disruptions we've seen in the U.S. and global economies and financial systems over the last 20 years. But I put a lot of emphasis on why it is that things don't turn out the way the basic economic textbook says they will in many cases. So why do we have terrible financial crises? Why does it take so long to recover from episode, or why did it take so long to recover from the Great Recession? How is it that we end up, you know, with this terrible surge of inflation after the pandemic? I mean, the textbook, if you read the textbook, it sounds like, well, here's your problem and here's your answer. But I think what's really important for the students is to understand that there are many, many other factors that shape those policy decisions. And I think it's important. So I teach that course partly because I think it's important that they understand that there are going to be all these other obstacles and constraints. But I think at the end of the day, my goal is to, you know, arm them with this more kind of nuanced view of how the policymaking world works and kind of teach them, you know, how they can best have an influence while still working off these important lessons they've learned in terms of the good economics.
Are the students enthusiastic about pursuing a career in this fraught field?
Yeah, I think that the great thing about working with students and people who are in the early part of their careers is that, you know, even when they see a world that's full of risks and, you know, bad things that are happening, they also see the future as being full of opportunities. And, you know, I think this is why, you know, I put a lot of emphasis on just these historical cycles we've been through with the economy. They correlate with cycles of other things going on more broadly in society and political systems, because I think there is a lesson there that, you know, we go through tough periods, but then, you know, with the right perspective on kind of what went wrong, we can get things on the right track again. And it's a wonderful thing about working with students is that they embrace these opportunities.
So there's an idealism about economics as a way to improve public policy outcomes and make our lives better that remains intact.
Yes, I do think that's true. Yep.
Well, Karen, thank you for coming into the IMF today to speak with us about your work and your career and the way that the economics profession can better engage the world.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Harvard professor Karen Dinan speaking with Jeff Kearns about Reclaiming a Policy Role for Economists, published in the June edition of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.